Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect it is 1:35 p.m. on Thursday, March 26, 2026. Present today are Senator Olson, Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yount will be with us shortly, and myself, Senator Merrick. This afternoon, we will hear a presentation from the Alaska Municipal League on the impact of property taxes on local school contributions. We've had a few bills through the committee relating to property taxes, so this will supplement that. We have Nils Andreasen, the Executive Director of the Municipal League, with us today. If you'd like to come forward, place yourself on the record and begin your presentation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. And for the record, Nils Andreasen, I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. Appreciate this opportunity to talk a little bit about property tax, and I will apologize in advance to those who know probably more about property tax than I do, having served in local government. But we'll be talking through kind of how property tax works across the state, what impact it has on communities, and ultimately how it feeds into state funding and or affects funding of the public education system. So. I will jump in and ask questions along the way or however you like.
Thank you.
First, and just to ground us, I want to kind of think about why a property tax. And we've got a few types of taxes that local governments can utilize in Alaska. It's worth noting that local governments are preempted by the state from levying a net income tax. So there's really property tax and sales tax, plus a few different types of sales or excise taxes that are available. But property tax is what we're going to focus on today. Property tax is really about funding services that affect property. So traditionally, it's been about being able to deliver roads and fire protection, police, that utilities, planning. It's extended to supporting schools in many states around the nation, and including in Alaska. And values are tied to the quality of those services. When you don't have access to your home or your facility, if you don't have fire protection or police, the value of your home goes down. That's why we've advocated over the years for when the state works toward subdivision development, that it makes sure that there's utilities and that there's access, and that's well developed so that it doesn't affect the property values of others. It's a stable, generally, and reliable source of revenue. Property values don't generally fluctuate as wildly as income or sales taxes. And so it's a consistent funding mechanism for essential services, and including for schools. That's why it's relied on by the state within its formula. Property taxes in Alaska are set and collected locally. There's a cap on how much local government can collect. Of 30 mils, nobody's at 30 mils, and it's worth noting no local government is above 20 mils, and we'll talk about mils in a little bit. But I think what's important about the fact that property taxes are set and collected locally, these are really local decisions. What do we want to fund? What are the services we expect from our local government? And then for those who have a property tax, what rate should we set that at to deliver those services? So residents have a direct influence on affecting decisions within local governments, and for kind of both sides of that. How much do we want to see come out of our pocket, and what do we want to spend it on? They're reliable foundations for communities who utilize them. But they require careful design. There's an element to property taxes that you really want to spend time on. What does fairness look like? What does affordability look like? And I think you've seen a lot of attention, especially in the media, around property valuation or assessment levels. When they are higher, there's a lot of attention, and fairness and affordability is at the heart of that public perception. So first, maybe just thinking about the Alaska's tax base for local governments, and I will apologize in advance throughout these slides. I'm using different fiscal years. Here it's 2023, later it'll be 2024. It's whatever was available at the time, and I'll try to differentiate along the way. But we did look at this tax base a few years back, and the available data was for 2023. So this is for all local governments, their revenue composition. And so for the total tax that was collected in 2023, 68% of it was through property tax. Sales tax, 19%. And I think it's worth noting that the majority of local governments utilize a sales tax as their base. There's only I think less than two dozen that levy a property tax. So we're talking about out of 165 local governments, most use a sales tax plus some of these other taxes. But you're talking about your highest population areas, your jurisdictions that you utilize that property tax. And for the most part, it's those with a municipal school district, but not all. So that's what that revenue composition looks like. And then in terms of a kind of what your calculable tax base is overall, what's taxable across the state, you're talking about 90% of your tax base is related to property. I threw in, and I think it's kind of worth the committee knowing about average tax concentration. So tax concentration is when does a jurisdiction use more than one tax? So if you were at, say, 100% concentration of tax, that would mean you're only utilizing one tax. And this is actually a good sign, this movement from 2002 to 2022, again, a different fiscal year, what was available, but a move toward greater diversification within communities, away from a single tax. So that means you're not just relying on a property tax, you're not just relying on a sales tax or a raw fish tax. And the value in reducing your concentration is that you're spreading out your needed revenues across a tax base that feels it differently, right? And it goes back to that fairness question, who's bearing the greatest brunt or burden of the tax? And the more you can be diversified, the more you can get to lower taxes, and you can spread it across seasonal type effects, temporary and so on. So here's just kind of a quick snapshot of what Alaska's local government tax base looks like. I'm going to focus now on and turn to kind of a deeper dive into property tax. And again, there are experts at the table who can relate probably their experience in any of this. But just to clarify, so for appraised value, that's the market value that we're talking about. When market values decreased, appraised values decrease. If market values increase, your appraised value increases. Your assessed value, on the other hand, is the taxable value of your property. So that's your appraised value minus the exemptions that might be applied. So you get to an assessed value that is different than appraised. And it's worth just kind of understanding those two terms along the way. And I think what's key to both is that we're starting with market value. The next slide talks a little bit about why that's important. We're one of a handful of states, two handfuls of states, that is a non-disclosure state. So local assessors don't know the market value. In other states that are disclosure states, the cost of a sale in the market is relayed directly to the assessor, who's able to use that to determine their appraisal. In Alaska, it's required in law. State statute sets out that market rate is required for that appraisal. And it's also true that local assessors don't know that market rate. So the transaction cost isn't disclosed. And what that experience then for assessors is it really has to do with, instead of the market value, they can get what information is publicly available, and the rest is utilizing a variety of methodology and kind of models for getting to what market rate might be. And also it's true that assessors are professionals. I mean, they come from they've got certifications that apply. There's an International Association of Assessing Officers that they turn to. There's U.S. standards that they look to. So we're talking about skilled professionals who are utilizing these methods, these standards, and so on to get to market value to overcome the fact that we're not a disclosure state. Some in the state do have access to those prices, real estate professionals, I think, in particular, through systems that they have access to that assessors don't. But this is a real burden and a barrier to actually getting to market rate, and it's worth, I think, especially the public to know what that looks like. We will turn to determining the mill rate. and again, feel free to jump in with here's how it works or worked in my community. But I think it's worth just kind of being really clear about what mill rate looks like. So it's an expression of dollars of tax levied per every $1,000 of value. So a mill rate of 12.5 can also be expressed as 1.25% or 0.0125 in decimal form. So it's so 1 mil is point. How does it work? 0.1%, 0.01%, 0.1%. And so 10 mils would be 1%. So it's easy to get those numbers confused, clearly, as I meant to demonstrate just there. But you'll see it come up when we're talking about different types of property and valuation. I have seen it come up in relation to LNG pipeline presentations during this session when they're using they're switching back and forth between a percentage and a mill rate. And that can really be unclear for an audience. So be clear about what we're talking about, and express your mill rate either in mills or as a percentage of as necessary, and just be consistent. Local governments set a budget based on expenses necessary to provide required services to residents. So the mill rate isn't just always the mill rate, unless you have it within your charter, which I guess a couple communities do. And that's a different issue. Sitka, for instance, I think has 12 mills in their charter. Not going to comment on that. But in general, local governments would determine, based on resident feedback, here's what we have to deliver. Here's what the state requires of us. Here's what the federal government requires of us. Here's what residents expense. Here's what that will cost. And then based on the taxable value of our property, here's the mill rate that will achieve the revenues necessary to meet those expenses.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is why I wanted to comment on, I think it's worth commenting on Anchorage, because Anchorage is the largest, by population. Anchorage has a tax cap. We know that the cost of the services that people of Anchorage desire and sort of want to see would cost more than we can take in the tax cap. The expenses because of inflation, because of the, people want police and fire. So Anchorage in recent years has always been at the tax cap. So it's more predictable because we know how much the tax cap is going to increase. There's a certain percentage that it's allowed to increase every year. That can change a little bit based on big projects and that kind of stuff. But generally, we know how much it's going to increase. That makes this more predictable. So we know what we're going to spend. We're going to spend what the tax cap is. And then once you feed in the assessments, it's easier to predict what the mill rate will be.
So every jurisdiction, I think, is a little bit is different. But in general, that's kind of how they're basing it. And for those who have tax caps or who have otherwise kind of, I wouldn't say artificially kind of set something in stone, they have to work the other way to say, here's what we're allowed. Here's what expenses might be, and how are we going to make up that difference? This assumes that you're not capped and that you're delivering a mill rate based on those needed expenses. So the amount is divided by the tax base, and again, the tax base is the sum of all assessed values. Assessed being the appraised amount minus the mandatory minus the optional exemptions in the jurisdiction to get to the mill rate. Some
at the Senator
end,
Dunbar.
No, sorry, Nils. Please finish this slide. And then I have something else I need to add.
No, you're and I appreciate that. Again, Nils, for the record, some of the mill rates are defined by state law. So I already mentioned, and I failed to include in these slides, the 30 mill rate in Title 29. The oil and gas property tax that's levied by the state at 20 mills is another layer of state-legislated mill. This is, it's not tied to how much is needed or anything within the state's budget. And within this particular type of tax, the local governments can apply up to that amount, and then the difference goes to the state. So if a jurisdiction who has oil and gas property has a 10 mill rate, 10 goes to that jurisdiction and 10 goes to the state. It's also true that in unorganized areas of the state where there's not a property tax, 20 mills goes to the state. And I think the way to think about that is the state, as the unorganized boroughs assembly, is collecting that property tax, and those funds are helping to pay for necessary services within the unorganized borough, like for REAAs or transportation or for platting and planning. The other mill rate that's defined by state law, and again, I would argue this is a state property tax, is the required local contribution. This is set at 2.65 mills, but it's only required to be implemented by those with municipal school districts. So local governments who have a school district have to equivalent that or the equivalent of that amount to their school district. And we'll talk a little bit later about what that means and what that looks like.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had to add an addendum to what I said before, because just sort of a cautionary tale for other local jurisdictions. Right before I got on the assembly, a group of fiscally irresponsible folks in Anchorage passed a ballot initiative, I think it was 8, but I can't remember the exact number, that made it so any gap between the property taxes collected and what the tax cap would have been was basically erased. And so they lower the tax cap. And what that actually did was make, because local governments know that, well, maybe this year we've been able to squeak underneath the tax cap, but we know in the future we're going to have to go, you know, because of a contract coming or inflation or whatnot, we're going to have to go higher. So it turned the tax cap into a ratchet. So now you have to hit the tax cap in order to make sure you have enough funds in future years. So it had this perverse effect. So I can't remember if it was 8 or 14. It was a ballot initiative about 10 years ago in Anchorage, and it had almost exactly the opposite effect that they said it would. That is also sort of changing the way that these things are done in Anchorage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Nils, so the 2.65 mills for the required local contribution, is that the most a community can give or the least?
Yeah, Chair
amount?
Merrick, so that's the base. And then beyond that, there's a cap that's established for how much a local government can contribute to education. But 2.65 mills is the required local contribution. All have to give that amount. For those who can give beyond it, they can only give beyond up to a certain amount. And I'm not going to spend so much time on the cap and that difference, because it's the RLC, the required local contribution, that actually has most effect on what the state then is able to fund.
Great. Please continue.
So I included here the mill rate by jurisdiction over the last 5 years. And you can see, and this is the effective mill rate, which is maybe not the rate that was set in code, but it's that rate applied to the tax base. So it's a little bit different than what you might see announced by each jurisdiction, but it has this is the effective rate. And you can see that there's variability, and I think that's what's important. I had numbers for this that went back further that showed actually we've reduced the mill rate pretty significantly over the last 20 years. But you can see how over the last five, it's the average mill rate has adjusted down just a little bit. There was a spike in 2022, likely post-COVID recovery efforts, and then back down, and then kind of leveling off here. The mill rate is really independent of well, it's not independent of valuation, but I've got on the right-hand side the average sale price for a single-family home. So assessed value, appraised value is really should be kind of following that blue curve, that blue line, pretty closely, if we knew what the price of a home was or a property. So you can see that evaluation would track according to the blue line. You can inflation adjust for that and kind of see how it smooths out actually over time. But the fact that the mill rate isn't increasing at the same rate as property or as the cost of a single family home is important, right? It means that just because your valuation, your appraisal goes up, it doesn't mean that more tax is necessarily being collected, or at least it doesn't have to mean that. That those things are tied together a little bit, but it's not always going to equal more tax. And actually, the mill rate can go down and will likely go down as appraised value goes up, because you won't need as much to achieve the same budget that's in front of you. And that varies if you've got a big project, if you've got a sudden shift at the state level, if school bond debt reimbursement, for instance, weren't reimbursed at the full amount, local taxpayers would have to make that up, and are actually, whether there's a cap or not, I think for debt obligations would have to. So mill rates would increase in response to things like that. But all other things being equal, if there weren't cost shifting that occurred within those cycles, you wouldn't see as much of a dramatic increase. So I'm going to shift gears to different exemption types. There are, I consider, kind of three levels here. We're constitutional, which are mandatory, and then there are mandatory exemption, then optional. Constitutional exemptions really have to do with property owned by federal, state, and local government. It includes charitable, religious, nonprofit, educational facilities. There are a few others, but those are some examples. Everybody has to exempt those properties. There are mandatory exemptions that the state decides that are in statute. If they weren't there, they wouldn't be deducted from the total tax base. The biggest example is senior and disabled veterans, and I'll talk more about that, I think, on the next slide. And then there are optional exemptions. And these are exemptions where the state in statute has said local governments may choose to adopt any of these optional exemptions based on their circumstance. The state allows these exemptions. And it's not a blank check. Within state statute, it's a long list of optional exemptions, and local governments have to work within that. But it's up to the state to allow or disallow optional exemptions. And here's just, again, a short list. And it's 25 or so, I think, long. So I just left this at this. But it's wide-ranging, right? Community purposes, which is a pretty broad category, university housing, economic development, residential renewable, an additional senior and disabled veterans. So you've got the mandatory exemption, and then that on top of it, timber processing, low-income housing owned by HFC or an RHA. I think what I would note from this slide is that these are all stacked, right? So they don't individually only apply to a property. If you were a senior and disabled veteran, you would get both the mandatory and, if your local government had it, the optional, and it would be one on top of the other and not just one or the other. So you could end up with quite, and you could add in additional other optional exemptions to further decrease your tax experience. And I included the graphic up top. This is the locally assessed value. So we kind of talked about what that looked like to begin with. The full value determination, which we'll talk about a little bit later, includes the locally assessed value plus the optional exemptions. And then to really get to kind of what your tax base is, it's the full value determination plus your mandatory exemptions that you're either taxing or you're foregoing. In terms of, this isn't complete, but I think this is kind of fun. I think keep in mind that when we're talking about property, Alaska is fairly unique in the nation in terms of actually how much property is owned by the federal government, how much property is public, right? Between federal and state government, local, I mean, I think I've always heard that 1% of Alaska is privately owned. Which shrinks your tax base down to 1% to some extent. And this shows kind of the breakdown across some jurisdictions, and we didn't have data for all. This was publicly available data, and we could go do a deeper dive. But it gives you some sense of every one of these bars kind of reduces the ability for a local government to apply its tax. And what we're working with at the other end is what's left. So I think that's worth noting that we're starting from a very small size. I mentioned mandatory exemptions. So in addition to who owns the property, there's a number of mandatory exemptions that are out there. The senior and disabled veteran is by far the largest, has the largest value of exemption. And this is in taxable value, not in lost revenue. And then you have kind of combined the nonprofit or charitable, nonprofit hospitals, education. You've got tribal or native allotment, churches. All of those combined to actually equal about the same amount as the senior and disabled veteran. But this is removing, in addition to federal, state, and local land ownership, an additional 12.4% of local taxable value can't be taxed by local governments. It's worth noting that when we look at kind of taxable value, these numbers are only based on those jurisdictions that actually assess based on any of these. Some don't, because why? They don't have the capacity. They might have contracted assessors that it would just cost more. And if you're not going to be taxing them on the other side anyways, it's an extra step that is too far for them. So this data may not reflect all the actual mandatorily exempted property that's out there. But just for what we have in terms of data, you're talking about $15.7 billion of taxable value. I know this committee, I think, has talked before about the farm use land, agricultural land. It's not, I think that what's important about that legislation and that statute is it's not technically a mandatory exemption. It's a preferential valuation. It has the same effect as an exemption, but it's just a different approach to how it should be assessed or valued. Versus some of these others, which are a more true exemption. I call out the senior and disabled veteran exemption because it has the most value to local governments. So we're talking about more than $100 million in lost revenue to local governments. And you can see that it means something different to different jurisdictions. And that's based on whether you have an older population or if you've got more commercial and industrial activity, the more kind of a tax base you have and that a senior population is a smaller or larger part of, that has an effect. So for this is fully half of what's mandatorily exempted. It's 6% of total taxable property, and it means something different for different jurisdictions. Where, you know, for Wrangell, it's more than 10% of their tax base. On Alaska, less than 1%. Every jurisdiction feels this a little bit differently, and they also have to make up the difference differently. If this isn't included, if they can't apply their mill rate to it, mill rates increase relative to what's taken off the tax base. So some are out there, $100 million, others are paying for, since the state is not. And I know this committee is familiar with the fact that in statute, that exemption is supposed to be reimbursed by the state and hasn't since 1997. Okay. Shifting gears to optional exemptions, in 2024, I think we found $27.4 billion in taxable value exempted. That includes real and personal property, including modeled values. It includes mandatory exemptions. Well, if you included mandatory exemptions, 34% of all property is exempt on top of federal, state, local, and tribal, which is constitutionally and federally exempt. So here's the share of real property that is subject to optional exemptions, leaving just about 75% available for that mill rate to be applied to, fully a quarter that is optionally exempted. The value of that real property that's exempted, and I mentioned these different types of optional exemptions previously, so this isn't the full list, but residential is by far the largest optional exemption. I think we heard the state assessor say 2 days ago that it's over $6 billion for this last year. By far, and across, not all jurisdictions use optional exemptions, as we'll see, but this is the most. The senior optional is used by some to make up the difference, especially for, and I think of it in terms of those most vulnerable, so trying to meet the needs of seniors who are impacted by, in many cases, markets that have increased pretty dramatically over the last few years. The other optional exemptions have much smaller, or much smaller in terms of total value. Here's a chart from Alaska Taxable, which is worth a read every year, just to refamiliarize yourself with some of these. This breaks down some of the main optional exemptions by jurisdiction, and then gives you a percent of the tax base that is exempted. There's a wider list of optional exemptions out there that is interesting data, but you can see, again, residential exemption, that $75,000 that's applied to residential is by far the biggest value. I think the percent of tax base exempted, again, is really interesting. For some, they don't have any optional exemptions. It's just three or four, I think, that I saw in the most recent data. In here, just very small, but it can be as much as 34% in Craig. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, that's Craig.
Yeah, Craig. 34.8%. Cordova, 25%, 23% in Valdez, Anchorage, 9.4%. The average, 8.6%. The average that I saw for 2020. More recently was about 9.7. So you're talking about optional exemptions, most recently being right around 10%. Everybody experiencing this a little bit differently, depending on their tax base. I am getting there. To education funding, that's where we wanted to get to. But I figured that quick intro to property tax was worth it. So all that leads to getting to the full value determination, which is part of the education funding formula. So I think some interesting things about the full value determination. One, it includes the state assessor has a role. And that's different than the state assessor having a role in Title 29 or the department having a role even. This is found in the education title, in Title 14. The reason is because the full value determination is used to determine public education funding. And in Title 14, the required local contribution is based on that full value determination. So the state assessor, in consultation with the assessor for each district in a city or borough, shall determine that full and true value of the taxable and real personal property. So full value determination is not the same as the local tax base that's actually used by the municipality, right? It's not the same as the assessed value of that municipality. So from the state's perspective, when we look at a full value determination, it appears that the municipality has a high tax base or a higher tax base than what each local government might be looking at. From the local perspective, to meet a higher RLC based on that full value determination, we'll talk through what that means, the effective mill rate actually has to be higher than what you would otherwise apply. Because the assessed value that is local, the locally assessed value has a different measure in terms of base than the full value determination. So the state assumes that a broader tax base exists than the one that a community can actually tax because it has optionally exempted so much of its tax base and on average 10%. So that means that the burden of the RLC in particular is felt by a greater, by fewer taxpayers. They're picking up a bigger difference because of the increases that the state assessor is responsible for adding back in. So what does that look like? On the right here is what the state assessor sends back to every local government. It's a little chart that says, you gave us a number that's locally assessed, $1.7 billion in taxable value. I'm the state assessor, and my responsibility is to get to full and true. So I'm going to add back in all your optionally exempt property. I've determined, in addition, that $400 million more has been left out of your locally assessed value. And therefore your full value is $2.1 billion. And then they add in personal property, which it's worth knowing 10 jurisdictions don't assess personal property. So this is an automatic increase for them. But the some personal property is optionally exempt, and then the state assessor also has their own formula for getting to what else is out there. So that, in this case, added in $450 million more in assessed value. So for a total of real and personal property, true and fair value, $2.5 billion, almost $1 billion more in assessed value than what the local assessor determined to begin with. And the mill rate then is... It developed based on the locally assessed, but for the required local contribution is based on that number that is almost $1 billion more. So the state assessor adds back optional exemptions, adds in personal property, and then applies methodological adjustments to ensure that there's consistency statewide. Still a question in my mind, I would love to know what that looks like, and there's more we're kind of digging into to try to figure out what those, what that methodology formula is, where the data is to back that up, to really get to what's in statute for doing this cooperatively, collaboratively. But ultimately, the full value determination is almost always higher than the value a community is actually taxing, which doesn't include all those additional elements. So they've got to fix things to make sure that their RLC then is applied to the locally assessed value, which means that the 2.65 that is attached to the full value determination actually has to be a higher mill rate to get to what's needed or kind of the equivalent from what's locally assessed.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to assist my comprehension of what you just said, when the state calculates the full value determination for and includes exempt and untaxed property, is that just the statutory exemptions and the mandatory and optional exemptions, or does that include state, federal, nonprofit, that fully untaxed land as well?
Right. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. This excludes mandatory exemptions. So it only includes optional exemptions and personal property plus whatever the add back means. But it doesn't include the mandatory exemption for senior and disabled veterans or for charitable properties or federal state lands.
Okay. So, right, the constitutionally obligated ones. So in that sense, you could see the state you can sort of see it from the state's perspective. The things that must be exempt are being kept out.
Yep.
And then municipalities have gone
further.
Further with the optional exemptions. Okay.
Yeah.
Not saying it's a good policy call. I'm just saying you understand that rational basis then.
Yeah. Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I mean, from the state's perspective, I mean, this is the right way to do it. I think from the public's perspective, they really need to understand what an optional exemption does, right? Ultimately, mill rates probably go up to make up that difference. Or an optional exemption that's being implemented is ultimately being paid for by somebody else. So I think that's ultimately what this means. The full value determination, just to kind of talk more about this. So property owners without exemptions bear more of the load. That's maybe self-evident. Businesses, especially those with taxable personal property, may carry more weight in some communities where there's more business activity, similar to what we saw with the slide about the senior exemption, where it's, one, a matter of what's your senior population and also a matter of how much business activity do you have. And then where there's not a personal property tax or where that's not assessed, real property owners absorb more of that difference. There's two charts here. One is the tracking the statewide full value determination history since 1968, I think. And I think this is fascinating because, one, it's a long period of time to be looking at. And two, there's some really clear trends following crashes, when market values have diminished significantly, you see periods of time during which the full value determination, the market value, doesn't recover quickly. And then once the market has recovered, there are large spikes in assessment. And I think this is really critical, a critical explainer of what the public is experiencing these last few years, right? We had a crash. The market didn't recover quickly. Valuation assessment didn't recover quickly. And what we're doing, what you're seeing now, is that recovery that has happened in our history in the past. And I think, you know, that's something that I hope the public understands more and more of. When you see an increase in the double digits of an assessment, it's not because you always see that. You see that in certain time periods following market corrections elsewhere. So this is also a market correction. It's just in a different direction than you experienced in previous periods. The other chart that I would point to is inflation adjusting total assessed value. So from FY13 to FY22, what you see is inflation adjusted assessed value, where assessed value isn't keeping up with inflation. And so you might see your statewide full value determination history increase, especially dramatically in some years. But even over those periods, you're not seeing it keeping up with inflation, thus the corrections.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is a really interesting second chart. I do wonder if we'd see a turn back towards a higher rate in 23, 24, 25, even relative to inflation, just knowing what the housing market has done. But my question is for the upper chart. Do you happen to know sort of what the average percent increase is? So it's got, you know, it's going up. It's got a couple of spikes. Do you know what the average is? 5%?
5%, yeah. 5%. Senator Dunbar through the chair. And for the record, my hand is saying 5. But just under 5% on average over, I think we looked at, you know, a 20-year period to get that number. But that's about what this shows too.
Thank you. Continue, please.
The full value determination is required in Title 14 to get to the required local contribution. So the required local contribution is 2.65 mils or equivalent of the full value determination. And it's implemented then by those local governments who have a municipal school district. So basically home rule, first-class cities or boroughs across the state, this list of school districts. The state controls the full value determination, and the full value determination and local assessment grows over time, and as you saw in the prior slide, sometimes substantially. And I think, you know, one of the things that we noticed in this is, and we'll see as we talk about where the RLC fits into the funding formula, is that really as the required local effort, the required local contribution increases, state aid declines. And so just from FY, from 2024 to 2026, in that two-year period, all other things being equal, and they probably weren't, but let's I want to assume for just to be simplistic, the required local contribution about saved the state $27 million. Department of Education and OMB has, I mean, everybody else would have lots of more complicated numbers to present you, and that would number would go down. That's fine. But the point, I think, stands. As the required local contribution goes up, state aid goes down, and I'll explain why, but I think that that's really interesting in how that works. It's also, I mean, the other thing to take away from this slide is that it doesn't increase dramatically for all jurisdictions, and in some jurisdictions, assessed value can go down, full value determination can go down based on the economics, optional exemptions applied, and so on. So it's not always true that things will go up, but in total, that's what that looks like. So the school funding formula includes the required local contribution. And this is, again, I'm not a public education expert. So this is my attempt at explaining the funding formula. Basic need equals the base student allocation times adjusted average daily membership. There's additional factors that where the ADM, the average daily membership, is adjusted, school size, district cost factors, and so on. But basic need ultimately is supposed to be like, here's what education should cost to deliver in these communities. Public school funding, which we're trying to get to with Title 14's full value determination, is state aid minus required local contribution minus impact aid. And so state aid is what the state pays after all the other required revenues are applied. So the other way to think about it is basic need minus the required local contribution minus impact aid plus, and this was an education contribution, quality schools grant outside my area, equals state aid. Does that make sense? I will explain it further. So if that's the funding formula, then what that means is that ultimately the state is a payer of last resort. So if state aid is calculated after subtracting what local governments put in and what the federal government would have given to local governments if the state didn't intercept it as impact aid, every dollar that is increased with the required local contribution reduces state funding for dollar for dollar. And even when the legislature increases the BSA, which raises the basic need, if the RLC is more than that, it may result in actual state aid being reduced as well. So it could be, for instance, where I know this last year, you increased the BSA, and some districts saw less state funding come to them because the required local contribution was greater than what the increase amounted to. So this state acting as a payer of last resort is interesting in as much as the state also has the constitutional obligation to provide a system of public education. Again, if basic need increases by $1 million due to the higher BSA, the required local contribution also increases, state aid doesn't. But if required local contribution is greater than basic need, then state aid decreases. The impact to schools is that even though the legislature may increase the BSA, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's more money from the state coming to a district. And the increase of the required local contribution simply replaces state funding, leaving districts with no net gain, all other things being equal.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's a required local contribution. My understanding is that some jurisdictions go above that required local contribution, and there's also a ceiling. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Dunbar, through the chair.
So how does this dynamic change, or maybe it doesn't, if, say, Anchorage, for example, I believe Anchorage is at the legal limit that we're allowed to give. How does that change this dynamic, or does it not?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it doesn't change. So the state aid is only tied to the required local contribution. If a jurisdiction gives beyond the required local contribution up to the cap, that doesn't affect state aid. That is just more that the school district gets, except there's an impact aid calculation. The more and not this is outside my presentation, but where a jurisdiction gives beyond its required local contribution, the more that it gives, the more impact aid the school district will receive. And that's a nuance that is also out there, but not the topic. I didn't include more of that here.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that, right. So if a jurisdiction spends more in education above the RLC, they get more money from the state. I'm not sure what exactly the ratio is, but my understanding is they get more from the state. Mm-hmm. And the issue in Anchorage was, you know, we're at the legal limit. So when you shift things, I'm trying to think which direction, either from the muni to the state or the state from the muni, I'm sorry, the muni to the school district to muni, you ended up impacting the amount that the state was giving as well. So it's kind of the, in some ways, it's sort of the opposite of this problem. The city is spending as much as you can. If you reduce the city's spending, so for example, if you arbitrarily docked that tax cap, you'd also be losing state aid. And I guess what that suggests then is for some folks that are losing state money because of this RLC, wouldn't a potential solution be for them to spend above the RLC, to start taxing themselves like Anchorage does, above the RLC, and then the state would give them more money through the impact aid?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I don't know is probably what I should say. I think it has to do with, I don't know that it results in more money necessary. So the RLC is tied to state aid, but so is impact aid. And so where they give more beyond the RLC, that means the state's not intercepting as much of impact aid. And that's probably where you get some of that nuance. And I think it's also the reason why the state intercepting impact aid where local governments give more is actually leading to inequity versus correcting for it, which is what it's intended to do. But the more a community gives, the more impact aid it receives, the less the state can use to use as state aid. I don't know what the net gain is in all of that, except it's a lot of like moving pieces. And I mean, it feels like a shell game in that space. And I don't know ultimately that school districts benefit from any of that.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'll say then sort of for the states, for the school districts, I'm sorry, for the jurisdictions that are not currently providing the maximum legal amount to the school districts, they could unambiguously increase funding for education by contributing more. But it's clear that here, because Anchorage is already at that legal limit, this unambiguously harms Anchorage. That is to say, whenever this number goes up, Anchorage is harmed, and there's nothing we can really do about it because we're already at the legal limit of the optional funding we can give to our schools.
Right.
Is that correct? Yeah.
Senator Murray, I think that's correct, through the chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Andreasen, is the reason that there is that upper legal limit because of a disparity test? Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, Chair Merrick. I should have brought my other slide deck on impact aid. So the disparity test is there. There's two tests of public education funding. One is adequacy. Are school districts receiving enough to educate a student? And I think there's litigation that saying the state's not. That's one test. The other test is equity. And basically, is state funding being distributed in a fair way across all districts? Or in other words, are we avoiding a circumstance where one community, because of its tax base, is able to pay whatever it wants to, and other communities that don't have a tax base at all aren't? And that difference between the two is so great that it's not fair under federal law. So the disparity test is meant to equalize, to some extent, those bounds. There are moral, I think there's good reason to work toward equity within Alaska. But the reason is to be able, is for the state to be able to utilize impact aid as state aid. So if it fails the disparity test then, and the test is set out in federal statute, you can utilize impact aid as state aid if you pass the disparity test. And the impact aid that the state's able to use decreases the state's own obligation, right? So public school funding is state aid minus RLC minus impact aid. So that impact aid is where there's kind of this other variable, and the more of that the state can use, the less it has to contribute. The effect of, additional kind of nuance to impact aid, it affects different districts differently. So since local governments with school districts, the more they give beyond the RLC, the more impact aid they can receive instead of the state using it, that benefits municipal school districts differently than REAAs, where the state can take up to 90%, takes 90% of impact aid from REAAs. So it automatically disadvantages those it's trying to help by taking the maximum amount that it can from them, versus municipal school districts that are allowed to, the more they give, the more they get, kind of approach. So yes, disparity test, you've got kind of this equalization in terms of how the RLC functions, but there's also an additional impact for those who are able to give more versus those who aren't, and less impact aid actually going to those who should have received it in the first place. And keep in mind, impact aid is meant to be local, right? It's meant to replace what otherwise would have been a tax base, but for the fact that land is owned by the federal government, or there are federal employees who are working within that jurisdiction. It's meant for local. The state intercepts it and discounts, utilizes that to discount what it would otherwise contribute, making it, again, payer of last resort.
Okay, super. Let's move on to sticky policy questions.
Well, I think we got there, too. Thank you. I think this is my last slide. So, all of this kind of leads me to really struggling with, is the funding formula, is the education funding formula working as intended? And the fact that the state's the payer of last resort is interesting, again, for this constitutional obligation question. Is the formula in place to actually meet the needs of districts or to manage state costs? And I would argue that the way it's structured right now, it's advantaging the state in a way that actually isn't meeting the needs of districts. We've had members ask whether, and I think we have a resolution adopted by members suggesting that the required local contribution be disconnected from the formula, that the state should be responsible for basic need, which would be its constitutional obligation, to the extent that local governments can give a required local contribution or more, they should be able to, and you could still have a disparity test somewhere in there. But right now, the fact that an increased BSA doesn't automatically increase state aid when the RLC is greater than means that the districts ultimately aren't benefiting from the formula, which it's really they're supposed to. So disconnecting the RLC from the formula means that local governments who could be giving more. For those districts who are struggling with current budget challenges, they could receive a greater benefit from a local contribution, especially if state aid isn't going to go up. Instead of the state being the payer of last resort, reverse the order and make state aid the number that goes up and additional layers, numbers that augment what the state's able to provide such that districts, again, are having their needs met. There's also legislation out there to smooth the increase of the RLC. If the state's not going to keep up with inflation through the BSA or otherwise, then at least make sure that the RLC isn't outpacing the state's aid so that we can have a clearer picture of what state aid should be in this environment. This is a just for fun question, and these are just questions. Should the state conduct a full value determination for all districts and the state make up the RLC for REAAs? So right now it's just municipal school districts who have a full value determination, but clearly the state assessor, by adding in optional and identifying personal property and adding in their add back, has data that could help them determine a full value determination for all regions of the state, including all school districts and REAAs. And in this case, the state could make up that RLC for REAAs, which wouldn't impact disparity, right? You could disconnect, allow for growth within the RLC, but the state would make up the difference for REAAs, which addresses disparity, and even better if the RLC were decoupled. It would actually, and by making things better, what I'm really trying to get to is, does it get to improvements to school districts? Does it get to public education funding differently than how the formula is structured right now? Ultimately, based on this presentation and kind of through this research, I think the question that we're struggling with is, are we sacrificing adequacy to avoid disparity? And that's kind of what I'm wrestling with. Are we avoiding enough to make sure that there's not too much of a difference between haves and have-nots? And I'm not trying to get to it. I wouldn't argue for the have-nots not having enough. But across the board, there's not enough. And it seems like the formula is there and in place to avoid the disparity and not to achieve what we actually need in terms of basic need to meet the needs of school districts and ultimately Alaska's students.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe there are two bills on the Senate side right now that attempt to address this and other issues. But one we heard in this committee, which is I think why you're giving this presentation, one of the reasons why, which would sort of artificially suppress, or the advocate would use the term smooth, full value determinations. The other bill, which we haven't heard here, and I don't know the details of, I think it's Bill 278, would sort of directly limit to 2% the growth of, I believe it's the RLC, but it might be a component of the RLC. And so my question is sort of, what is AML's preference? Something that holds down the full value determination, or something that is sort of directly tied to the RLC and education funding?
Yeah, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, our preference would be that the state fund education better.
Yes.
Members have passed resolutions in support of increasing and inflation proofing the BSA. Ultimately, when we are looking at an RLC that has increased in the last couple of years by 27 million, which has meant a 27 million or so decrease in state aid. That's really what those bills are trying to address. How do we not offset what the state should otherwise be obligated to? So smoothing either the RLC or the full value determination is meant to affect that, I think, to an extent. And that's It's not. I think the 5% smoothing is more related to property tax that's experience or property assessment appraisal that's experienced by homeowners and property owners. Like it's more about how do we avoid those large spikes that we saw here? I mean, these large spikes, it would limit that, which would, I think, increase confidence within within the public about, you know, concern for 40% or 7% or, you know, whatever those look like. Even though the data here say that, I mean, there's reasons why those spikes and over time they're about even, and also they're not keeping up with inflation. So, like, those are other kind of nuance and questions that that bill will probably have to kind of wrestle with. But the 2% smoothing is really to get to this. This would save local governments money, which they could maybe put into getting closer to the cap where they're not already. And many are, or to meeting other needs that are out there, including to add circuit breakers to meet the needs of those more vulnerable residents. So some clear value, I think, in both of those bills and trying to achieve different issues, but kind of this broader question of those spikes. I think maybe that's where I'll leave it at. Ultimately, they don't change... necessarily, they don't benefit school districts, right? So if they can smooth out the RLC, but if it doesn't result in more state aid as a net gain and overall total school funding, then they're not making the difference that school districts need. They're solving for different problems, and it would be nice to solve for all of them.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you for the presentation. And I also want to thank you for really being engaged, not just on this issue, but other issues that affected municipalities throughout the state. And I also want to, my last comment is thank you for your municipal minute. I think that's what it's called, right? I really enjoy reading those. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Anything further from committee members? Seeing none, Mr. Andreasen, thank you very much for the educational presentation. We will give it some thought. And this will conclude our agenda for this afternoon. Stay tuned for our next meeting, date, and agenda. With that, we are adjourned at 2:42 p.m. Thank you.